Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's fizzy water time. The sun is out. I've got boiling hot water, 100 degree. I've got chilled filtered water, and I've got chilled sparkling filtered water too. The sun is out and I'm using that every day. Absolutely delicious. I love Cooker. I love the company. I want to thank them again for sponsoring this podcast. Great product. If you can't afford it, I recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk. Someone told me actually, that sort of barbecue weather as well, isn't it? My street stinks of barbecue every night. But someone tells me that you boil chicken before you barbecue it, and then it becomes more succulent. Is this true? I mean, I work on a cooking show, so I should know. Maybe I'll ask them. But you could use the boiling hot water. That's what the point I'm trying to make. You can boil your chicken before barbecuing. It doesn't sound very good, but that's what I heard they do in restaurants. I'll find out. Today we're revisiting a subject we've done before, but I do think it's worth it, as it is a reminder of how much life has changed, and maybe we're not all coping with it very well. Today I'm curious about the impact on a generation born into the digital world. Today I'm having a conversation with Robert Wigley, who has written a book called Born Digital, The Story of a Distracted Generation. Let me tell you about Robert. He's quite an impressive man. Robert backs young entrepreneurs in cutting-edge technology businesses and is chairman of UK Finance. He sits on the UK's Economic Crime Strategic Board, co-chaired by the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Home Secretary. He spent a career in finance, rising to be EMEA chairman of Merrill Lynch. I think EMEA stands for Europe, Middle East and Africa. And he's a member of the board of the Bank of England during the 2008 financial crisis. He was chairman of the Green Investment Bank Commission and wrote a seminal report, Winning in the Decade Ahead, on the future of London as a global financial centre for Boris Johnson, when he was London mayor, or mayor of London. I mean, his list just goes on. He's a fellow of the Institute of Chartered Accountants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why has he written this book? Well, we're about to find out. Obviously, it's disturbing him. He's got children, and I suppose they've been born into the digital world. We'll find out. Let's find out what he thinks. Here's Robert. Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm really well. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm very well, thank you. Before we get into the book, by the way, I thoroughly enjoyed the book, but I think everybody would, because it's so poignant to all our lives. Can I just go into your, I was just reading out your CV, which is so impressive, from the back notes. But you're heavily involved in finance at the moment. What is UK Finance?
We're an organisation that represents the UK financial services industry, and I chair it.
Okay, so how bad a situation are we in at the moment? Because, you know, we're going to get into this subject in a minute, but I obviously spend a lot of time talking to, reading online about how dire the country is in. How bad is it at the moment?
Well, so overall, in terms of the economy, it's not so bad. We're moving from a position of having had quite good growth relative to other countries in the G7 to being, I would say, stagnant in terms of growth. But we're still only around zero, so not in recession. We may well end up in recession. We'll have to see what happens over the next 12 months. I think where there are challenges is what has now become known as the cost of living crisis. I think there are a lot of people on lower incomes who are struggling with the price impacts of, you know, energy price increases and some of the supply side shocks causing price increases across a whole range of categories. And for that group of people, life is going to be very difficult for the next couple of years as pay increases don't keep pace with inflation. So, yes, it's a serious situation, but not yet a recession.
Are these things cyclical? Because it seems in my lifetime, I'm 54 now, I seem to have seen a couple of these situations before where the finances of the country seem all over the place. We all seem like we're heading for a recession. Everyone feels miserable, strikes everywhere, and then it sort of comes out and then it goes again. Is it a cyclical thing?
Well, I hope so. And I think, you know, here we do have some one-off factors. We've obviously had COVID, we've had the overhang from COVID, we've got Ukraine, and we've got some very specific supply side issues, you know, around energy prices, all of which should ameliorate over a 1 to 2 year period. So there's no reason to believe this will be any different from any previous bad experience like this. And I hope in 18 months to 2 years, things would have improved, you know, very substantially. But time will tell. What we need to make sure is that these this short-term inflation we're suffering doesn't feed through to a permanent expectation of higher inflation, which then could cause problems. So, but that's what the Bank of England is heavily trying to avoid.
Yeah. So who's in charge of this? Who's going to make it work for us? By the way, I'm quite ignorant on these things. Is it the Bank of England or is it the government?
Well, it's both. It's both. So the Bank of England is responsible for setting interest rates, which is really all about trying to do what they call de-anchor price expectations. That means not allow the idea of higher inflation to become embedded in people's expectations. That's really what interest rate increases are about. And then the government will have to take some measures in terms of, you know, tax adjustments and short-term subsidies to help people through a very difficult period. So it's a combination of both.
Hmm. And whilst there's that going on, sadly, the internet is just getting us to try and take sides, isn't it, constantly about where we're positioned ourselves, whether we think the government or the Bank of England or anyone can actually do anything to help it or not, and which is the nature of your book, isn't it, really?
Well, because one of the things about news on the internet is that the neuroscientists who design the algorithmic feeds that send us our social media news know that bad news is more engaging than positive news. So I'm afraid we do tend to get an emphasis on the bad news. So that is a problem, yes.
Yeah, just as we're speaking, there's the big polio has come back. I think there's one case of it at the moment or something, but the papers are saying that polio is back and it's going to be, you know, coming into our houses soon. It that's how it operates. But I suppose that's the way press always operated, wasn't it?
Yes, I can't say that I'm particularly worried about polio. I think that's a it's a very serious illness, a disease, but it's also very rare. And I think this thing about London water at the moment is a very short term problem. So I'm not too worried about that. I think probably more worried about 1.7 million cases of COVID still flying around. But hopefully it's becoming weaker and weaker every time we get another wave, so we can be a little more relaxed than we were in the first wave.
Okay, Robert, tell us why you wrote this book. It's called Born Digital, The Story of Distracted Generation.
So I wrote it because I was watching my children and the effect that I perceived the internet to have on them. And I noticed actually particularly a difference. I have three boys who, when I wrote the book, were sort of 20, 18 and sort of 16. I noticed the 16-year-old was very different in his use of technology from the older two. They were very much sort of in the Facebook and Instagram sort of era. The younger one was on Snap and Twitch and some of the newer platforms. And I wanted to just explore what all this was doing to the development of their personalities, how it was affecting the way they saw the world. And that's really that was the impetus behind me doing the research to write the book.
And?
Well, and what I found was mixed. The book is not wholly critical of the internet. It would be, to be honest, pointless writing such a book, since the internet has become completely ubiquitous in every aspect of our lives, whether it be to the point you just made about how we consume news, to how we shop, to how we entertain ourselves, how we educate ourselves. It's completely ubiquitous in every aspect of our lives. So it'd be kind of pointless writing a book just criticizing the internet. But I do think that these massive companies that dominate the internet, which basically have sort of grown from nothing over a 10-year period, I think you do have to question their business models and ask whether they're taking enough responsibility for the information they feed us and for the potentially sort of compulsive use that smartphones and laptops and gaming consoles have developed, and whether that's doing our adolescent children any good. And if you look over the last 10 years, the same 10 years that these large companies have become very large and this technology has become ubiquitous in our lives. So the negative factors, as I call them, that's things like loneliness, unhappiness, anxiety, depression, and then ultimately self-harm and suicide have broadly speaking doubled. Now, you can't obviously level all of that at the internet, but and indeed academics have desperately tried to prove a causal link and failed. The evidence is not remotely compelling on that subject, but I simply don't believe that that's a coincidence. So I do think we have to question whether these companies are taking enough responsibility for the effect that their products have on our children.
Do you have a smartphone and are you addicted to it?
I have a smartphone, and I've taken steps to use it less compulsively than previously. If you ask my children, they'd probably disagree. My wife would almost certainly disagree. You have to be very careful, by the way, with the word addiction, because addiction, you know, to the internet companies and to doctors has a very specific kind of meaning. So I prefer to use the word compulsive use, because I think it would be very difficult for most of us to argue that we don't compulsively use our devices. If you look at Generation Z, which is the focus of my book, you know, we know that they spend, depending on which survey you look at, between 9 and 11 hours on screens during a day. And that's all screens. So that's your mobile, it's your laptop, it's your gaming console, it's your iPad, might be watching Netflix. Now, the question, to be honest, which I've learned the answer to, is not really about screen time. It's not about how much time you spend on screen. It's what you're doing when you're there. Are you doing good things? Are you doing bad things? So, for example, if your adolescent child uses their screen to educate themselves for 2 or 3 hours a day, maybe having an hour of gaming, maybe an hour of looking at social media, watch a film, that's all fine. If they're spending 5 hours a day plus gaming, or in particular, if they're between, let's say, 11 o'clock at night and 2 in the morning, mindlessly chilling and scrolling through social media feeds, I'd be a little more concerned, because there we know there can be very negative impacts in both cases.
Yeah, just to play devil's advocate, though, when the TV was invented, everybody hated that, didn't they? They all said that it was going to give you cancer and it would ruin you and you get square eyes and all the other things. And look, by the way, I'm totally, I want to use the word addicted, because I'm totally addicted to my phone. I've discussed it a lot. I keep on trying to do things to stop doing it. I find I need an iPhone for my work, and so I can't just completely get rid of it. And then it keeps drawing me back in. So I do feel like I have a horrendous addiction to it, which I'm not happy about. But I wonder if we're making more of an issue than it. I mean, I don't think this, by the way, but
we're
I'm just
and I'm so glad you raised that as the sort of precedent example, because when people raise those concerns and people then started analyzing the effects of the TV, we ended up with quite a lot of regulation. We have something called a watershed, so you can't show certain kinds of activity on television, you know, before 9 o'clock in the evening when children might be watching. You can't advertise certain kinds of products because we're worried about, you know, what effect that might have on our children. So there's a whole load of regulation around broadcast television, which does not apply to the internet. And that's kind of the point. You know, this phenomenon has grown up incredibly rapidly, and the regulators are running to catch up slowly, but getting there.
What's funny about that is TV has regulations, and yet the internet is now impacting television. Take Love Island, for instance. You always get this argument, you know, they basically taking a load of young people, put them on TV and torture them for our entertainment. They sort of get them involved in relationships, and they split them up and they play with their emotions and they do all that. And everyone goes, the argument of why it's good is they always say, but they know what they're getting themselves into. They literally have no idea what the hell they're getting themselves into, because they're connected. And as soon as they walk out of that TV show, they go in thinking they're a lovely person. That's what everyone thinks. Everyone thinks they're a good person, right, in some way or form. There's very few genuine people who think they're genuinely evil. Most people think they're good people, and they walk out going, hold on a second, everyone hates me because of something which happened, or then someone starts having a little bit of a pop at them somewhere here, or criticism there. They have no idea what they've let themselves in for. And when they, before they went in, they might have had a few thousand followers. Now they're into tens or hundreds of thousands, even up to millions of people critiquing them. And I know this because I'm on TV, and so I have it constantly, and I've had it via email and everything constantly throughout the last 25 years. And still it can get to me every now and then. So it's ridiculous that they think there's regulations involved with that, even when there's the internet involved.
There is very little or no regulation yet about that. It's coming. I'm sure we're going to come on to talk about the online safety bill in a minute. But I had a friend, actually, whose brother went on to Love Island. And one of the interesting things, which I didn't know, is that when you go on Love Island, you have to basically leave your mobile phone behind, and you don't have access to your own social media accounts. So my friend, who is a social media marketer, took over his brother's social media accounts. And he said within 24 hours, this guy was getting vitriolic abuse, you know, in very large quantity. And he said to me, I'm very glad my brother didn't see it until he came off the series, because it would have killed him. It would have absolutely killed his confidence. Yeah. They basically said he was boring, not very good looking, overweight, you know, blah, blah, blah. He was the least interesting person on the program. Probably the best thing that happened to him was that he got voted off quite early, quite honestly. But the brother was literally shocked to the core with what he was reading in terms of the vitriol that came in.
Yeah, it's not pleasant. And going back to the suicide stuff and people getting miserable and depression, I think what the internet does is it really exaggerates desire, which is never good if you've got too much desire, and fear of missing out. I've done a podcast on this before where you know you're missing out. It's impossible not to miss out these days because there's so many choices open to you. So you're always going to be missing out. And what the internet does is shows you constantly how much you're missing out on the world. And I think as older people, we're able to maybe understand it a bit, but as a younger person, there's just not a chance they're understanding this. So, you know, how are we getting on with putting some guidelines in place for the internet?
So I think it's not just what you call FOMO, although I would argue, and I talk in the book actually about there's something else, which is the fear of having nothing to miss out on. But the bigger issue actually is, you know, as in the comparison with someone else's phone who's buzzing even more than yours. And oh my God, does that mean I'm a boring person because no one wants to talk to me? I think the bigger issue, honestly, is peer-to-peer comparison. So I remember reading a book when I was 16, which was designed to give adolescents self-confidence. And there was a chapter which said that the trouble with people with big noses is that they always compare themselves to people with perfect noses, not people with average noses. Because if you think about it, if you compare yourself to someone with an average nose, you know, you're kind of not much worse than half of them. And of course, what the internet and social media does is create that problem on steroids, because everyone looks perfect. I mean, you only make the post after either doctoring it or taking the picture from a certain angle or doing your makeup or making sure the lighting is right. So everyone looks, you know, like they're in the top 1% the whole time. And of course, most people aren't. And so there is a constant, we shouldn't be surprised, I think, that our kids get depressed and upset because they don't look like most of the people in the pictures. Everyone wants to have the biggest abs, the best eyelashes, the bluest eyes, the nicest hair, the longest nails, whatever it happens to be. And of course, most people don't. So it's unsurprising that peer-to-peer comparison causes depression. So in terms of what's coming is the online safety bill. It's being promoted by the British government. I have to say, I know it's not very popular to praise the British government, but on this, I think they genuinely deserve praise because it will be world-leading legislation. It's the first attempt in the world to put a statutory duty of care, a bit like health and safety legislation, onto the big tech platforms to say, if you're going to serve up material to children, you better have regard to what impact it has on their mental health. And if it's having a negative impact, you need to take steps to mitigate those negative impacts. And Ofcom every year will assess, you know, what Meta is doing, what Snap is doing, what TikTok is doing. And if they don't consider those companies have taken adequate steps, they have the ability to fine them really quite aggressively. So it's coming through Parliament this year. We have to make sure it doesn't get watered down. And then we have to really push Ofcom to levy heavy fines if they think, after their assessments, that the big techs are not taking sufficient action to protect our children.
Oh, but what is it that you can do to protect them, though? What material do we think is dangerous to them? Because isn't it all dangerous in a way? Because it's got that the word you don't like, but it's addictive. I mean, TikTok, just people dancing is addictive.
There's something else that the government is doing in parallel, which is it's now called the Children's Code. It was called the Age Assurance Code. What it basically says is that the big tech platforms need to understand how old their viewer is and then take steps to control what goes to them so that it is appropriate to their age. It's age appropriate content. So the answer to your question about what you can do is you can restrict access to certain kinds of materials if you don't think it's age appropriate. That's the main thing you can do. And that is what will have to happen after this legislation comes into force.
But that's not going to help at all, is it? What is that? What is that doing? It's you know, the stuff which is the problem is the stuff which keeps getting them back involved. That's dancing and singing and people putting makeup on. And, you know, the music industry is so heavily invested now in the internet. I mean, they're getting their artists to release tracks just purely for TikTok. They have days when they're promoting their records where they spend 6-7 hours just making TikTok material to try and capture the children in to listen to it. I mean, it just feels like it's missing the point a bit, isn't it?
So I think the point you're making was made really brilliantly by Tim Wu, who's a professor in America who's now advising President Biden on what to do about the internet. And he said, you know, if you have on one side of the screen a partially developed adolescent brain and you have on the other side of the screen 100 of the world's best neuroscientists, it's pretty clear who's going to win that battle, right? And that's kind of the issue that we've got. But I'm not so negative, because in the book, I set out things that generation can and is doing itself to recognize some of the negative impacts of the internet and take steps to protect themselves. What parents can do. One of the big things here is parents tend to engage with their children about their offline lives. You know, we said, what did you do today? Oh, I went to the park, played football with John, went for a drink, came back. We don't say, okay, interesting, but I couldn't help but notice you were up last night late for 3 hours, you know, in your room on the internet. Do you mind telling, you know, who were you talking to? What kind of issues came up? What were you doing? We don't do that because we think it's intrusive. Actually, to Generation Z, because they see no boundary between the on and offline world, it's just the world to them. Whereas we grew up in a time when there was a clear distinction. They don't mind being asked those questions, particularly if you share your own experiences. So I think we need to engage ourselves more in what they're doing on the internet without appearing to be intrusive, and just talk to them about what they're doing and warn them about some of the dangers of internet relationships. And Professor, one of the top cybersecurity professionals in the world, talks about the predator in the home. You know, your 13-year-old son goes up to their bedroom, and because they're in the house, you think they're safe. If they went into the back garden and there were 5 50-year-old men hanging over the fence talking to them, you'd probably go out and ask what the hell was going on. If they're up in their bedroom, you think they're safe, but actually the internet is far, far more dangerous than them hanging around in the back garden talking to people over the fence. So we call it the predator in the home. And I think parents need to wise up to how dangerous the internet is, even though it's within the home.
Yeah, the decision I've made on that is to not let my 9-year-old daughter have any technology. So I'm just doing that until I'm holding out as long as possible. In your book, you actually say the time kids usually get is like smartphones is around 11-ish when they go to secondary school, isn't it? So I'm holding out for that, like, you know, trying to.
The trouble your book, is, by the way, with what you're on. Doing, which is called police and restrict. That's what the psychologists call it. Is that it does set up, you know, a big tension. Another big tension between the parent and the adolescent child. So I think what we talk about is educate and engage. So allow them some access, but talk to them about what they're doing and try and educate them about the dangers. That's what the professionals tell you to do.
Yeah, though the reality of that, I get it, but the reality of that is she comes home at my house because I'm not with her mother, and I have a 3-4 evenings a week, generally 3, and she comes home and she just knows there's no technology there, so she just gets out and we go into the garden and play, or we'd start doing art together and stuff like that. So her mind's programmed towards that. I don't know what she does at her mum's house, but that's what happens at my house. So I do think kids are able to do what we did, which was we had nothing. We were bored out of our brains, so we had to go and find something to do, generally involving a ball in my case. But you know, that's what they did. Your book, by the way, is absolutely rammed full of stats and great facts and figures. That must have taken you a long time to collate all this book.
So actually writing it was a slightly terrifying process. I on the first day I'd sort of made some notes and done a bit of research, and so I decided to Google my intended chapter headings. And then I completely panicked, because what I discovered was that someone had written either one or more than one book on every single chapter I was about to write, an entire book. So I thought, well, then I have to read these books, otherwise I might, with, you know, unwittingly be plagiarizing something else that someone's already said. So I had to read 35 books in a month. It was actually during lockdown, that lovely April of the first lockdown, I sat in the back garden and literally, I probably read more books than I've read since I left university in total. But at the end of that, for about 5 minutes, I genuinely was the world's expert on this subject, because I shouldn't think anybody else has read all of those books. And what I discovered was that about 30 of them were sort of academic studies. They got all the research, all the data, but had no solutions. 3 or 4 of the books were really good. They had both analysis and then came up with some ideas. So I wanted to write a book that had the facts, but then goes on to talk about some of the solutions. And I hope that's what it achieves.
One of the big things we discuss constantly is privacy, don't we? And I wonder if that's just a thing which is in fashion at the moment. I mean, I remember when there was telephone books, we loved the idea of having our phone number anywhere. Everybody could have our number and call us. Now we're like obsessed with privacy and data. I mean, I think that ship sailed. I was at a conference once, and there was a hacker saying, basically, if I want to get any information on you, I can. It's just don't ever put anything out there that you don't want people to know because I can get a hold of it. Is it just fashionable at the moment that we don't want anyone to have our data and we want privacy, or is there a real problem with it?
Oh, so I think it goes back to the point I was making about how quickly these companies have grown up and how quickly they've amassed so much data on all of us. And what will happen over time is regulation will catch up, societal opinion will catch up, and we'll hopefully over time we'll get back to some point where we have a little more control of who's allowed to use our data for what. And the EU actually, you know, deserves a bit of credit here for creating GDPR, which is at least designed to give some people some privacy. But I want to raise a different point with you, which is anonymity rather than privacy. So when the internet was designed, it was all about, you know, free giving access to everybody to lots of information, and that's a laudable principle. But unfortunately, the way it's developed, we have allowed people to roam around the internet pretending to be someone else, and that has all sorts of very negative consequences. And so, I'm a very strong proponent of moving regulation to the point where if you want to sign on to a platform, you have to identify yourself. Now, that doesn't mean, Tim, that you couldn't have a profile on Instagram that was in another name. What it would mean, however, is that if you did one of four things, if you were spreading fake news or hate speech, or you were cyberbullying someone, or God forbid, you were involved in technology-assisted child sexual abuse, and someone, the victim of any of those things, complained about you to the platform would actually know who you were, and can either take steps to block you or shut your accounts or, in extremis, report you to the authorities. So I'm afraid I think anonymity must go. It's only a question of time. The web libertarians, I can hear them gasping from here. They hate the idea, but it would stop most of the bad behavior. And there are really only two objections which people bring up, and neither of them are valid. One is people say, well, look, in totalitarian regimes, if you couldn't be anonymous, then the state would know, you know, everything you thought about everything, and that's a terrible thing. Well, I'm afraid I don't think that the mental health of Britain's adolescent children is less important than protecting, you know, people in totalitarian regimes. Totalitarian governments will do whatever they want to do anyway. So that's not a valid argument. The second argument people use is that famous people wouldn't be able to use the internet because everyone would see it was them. That's not true either, because in my model, it's only the platform who knows who you actually are. You can still have a profile in a false name. So I think we've got to do away with anonymity. It's going to take a while, but I'm pushing ministers very strongly on that.
Yeah, I think it's sort of connected to your first point, but the whistleblower, the victim with his anonymity or the lady, then they're not able to just sort of tell their truth without being identified is one of the arguments too.
Well, that's a failure of the whistleblowing policy. I mean, I've worked in lots of companies where we have effective whistleblowing policies where there is an absolute requirement to protect the whistleblower once they've instigated the whistleblowing procedure. So I can't believe that isn't soluble in a different way. And I don't think it's a reason, I'm afraid, to allow the much wider problem that anonymity creates for our children and others, not just children. I mean, the amount of abuse that female MPs get, that minorities get, is totally unacceptable. If I walk down the street and I racially abuse someone, that person will go and find a policeman, they'll complain, I'll be interviewed, I'll have to give my name and address. If someone does the same thing on the internet, they don't have the same consequences, and that's unacceptable.
Yeah, being the receiver of that for quite a long time, I just, whenever you look at the people who are abusing you, they generally don't have any followers. They're generally just, I don't know, you don't get anyone who's accountable really abusing you because of what you say there, you know, so they don't have a mass of people following them because then they'd be able to be identified. So they're just kind of, they're disgruntled people who are having a pop at the guy on TV or throwing a bit of racism around or a bit of sexism. I'm not saying it's right, but that is what it is. It's fair, that is what we're dealing with. What I struggle with often is how people react to it. Because you can see that, you know, sometimes there's 10 followers. It's like, why are you reacting to someone with 10 followers? All you're doing is amplifying it constantly. And it makes it into a bigger problem, I think. But then I could be wrong on that.
No, I don't think you're wrong. But unfortunately, we live in a world where apparently there is no smoke without fire. You know, we live in a cancel culture. And as soon as someone is accused of something, you know, everyone assumes it. And the fact that it came from a bot or a false account, you know, that has just got a bad person behind it that's got no followers, I'm afraid doesn't stop that rumor spreading and, as you say, being amplified. So I think we do have to deal with it.
Yeah, and I think this is the problem. Actually, look, I'll bore my listeners again because I've said this so many times, but, you know, when we look back on this generation, this era of the world's history, we're not going to be talking about Boris Johnson and Donald Trump and Barack Obama and pandemic. We're going to be talking about the internet and how it's absolutely, you know, technology and the internet has absolutely changed the way we live. Completely, I think, like the print world did many moons ago. And one of the biggest problems, I think, there wasn't enough adults around. So when the children, and I'm calling adults, some adults children, by the way, were on going, oh, sack him, do this, do that. When the children who were going, oh, we're worried about our commerce here, then started sacking people rather than going, hold on a second, this is a ridiculous situation here that you're letting the younger generation or you know, people who've got an axe to grind actually start attacking people, and then the adults not going, yeah, well done, but, you know, we're not going to judge this person on one sentence or one thing they did or something historical. It all became very childish, the internet. Do you not think?
That's a really difficult question to answer. So I'm not sure you can blame that on the internet, actually. I think that's a societal issue. So one of the things I do in the book is run in parallel the build-up of the internet with a whole load of other things that are going on. Because as I said earlier in the interview, you can't lay all of this at the door of the internet. And what else is going on is, for example, the different way in which youngsters now meet each other and the kinds of in inverted commas, relationships they have, what I call encounters, not relationships, a much more transactional style of meeting and bluntly, you know, sexual relationships, the hookup culture. You've got a decline of the nuclear family. I mean, most of us grew up, you know, in a home with two opposite sex heterosexual parents. Less than 50% of children in America now grow up in that scenario. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's different, and you've got to recognize that it's going to have an impact. Communal eating. Most of us grew up with regular family meals where we sat around and looked at each other and there were no phones. That's pretty much gone. Most people now eat a lot of meals on their own, or they have what I call food on the go. They nip in somewhere, it's quick, they're standing, talking, probably looking at their phone while they're eating. They're not doing the communal eating thing, either socially, you know, or at work, where it's also disappearing. You've got the decline of religion. We live in a pretty much post-religious society. So you can't blame all that on the internet. I think you do have to look at all these other factors, but they all add up to a sort of an attack on empathy. And that's the big issue. That's why I think society is so polarized, because unintentionally, but systematically, technology attacks all the places where empathy used to develop, starting with the mother looking at the baby in the pram. Now the mother's holding a phone, the baby's probably got an iPad strapped to the pram. So you've basically interjected two devices between the eyes of the parent and the eyes of the child. That carries on through childhood. Parent comes home, they're busy, they're still working at home, the child's on their device. So this, what we're doing now, Tim, you and I looking at each other in the eye, and if I say something you don't like, you wince. If I say something that's funny, you laugh. That instant feedback mechanism, which is what creates empathy, does not develop the same way in Generation Z, because many of the places where it should develop have disappeared.
I wonder if this is a societal problem or an individual problem. I wonder whether as individuals we have to take responsibility for how we want to live our lives rather than thinking it's part of society's problem.
Well, we do. We absolutely do. And, you know, in the book, again, I got a section which starts with, well, what can you do? What can we all do? whether it be taking some of the apps off our phone, disconnecting ourselves from apps, moving apps to a second page. So you actually have to think to go to Instagram or Facebook or Snapchat or TikTok. They're not just constantly sending you notifications on the front page. Turn your notifications off. Limit the amount of time you spend on them a day. All sorts of things we could do. But as I said, you like this word addiction. I call it compulsive use. You've got neuroscientists who designed the color of the app, the sound of the notification, the moment that it happens, deliberately to attract and retain your attention. That's what they're paid to do. And so, yes, you can ask people to do those things, but the truth is the science is against them because the world's best neuroscientists have designed both the hardware and the software to attract and retain your attention. So we have to go beyond asking people to think about how we design these products, how we design the software and the hardware, how we educate not just children, society generally about use of the internet and the dangers of online relationships. There's a whole range of things we have to do. And if you did it all, then you'd have some chance of making an impact.
Yeah, do you know, I grayscale my phone because when I get a lot of problems, you know, and I start going on my phone constantly, I have to grayscale it so that it looks boring and then I don't go on as much. That's how addicted I am to it. So the bit in your book that I really love because it really hit home is clicktivism, slacktivism. That really makes sense to me that you are, well, I love the fact you wrote about that because that seems to be a massive thing that is happening in society at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is, for those who haven't read the book, this is about how the internet is affecting politics, the way we politic, the way we receive news and information, the way politicians communicate with us. It is pretty scary because we have news feeds which are algorithmically designed to, in effect, tell us what we want to hear. In other words, if you look at a particular person with a particular view and you look at him two or three times, you're probably going to get more of him in your feed. And the problem with that is that you end up with a kind of one side of the argument, the side that you want to hear. Just as maybe my parents bought the Telegraph newspaper and someone else's parents bought the Guardian, except that it's completely ubiquitous, right, in terms of everything you're reading. I just think just last week there was a new survey out which looked at the fact that kids under 25 get all their news from social media and they just don't read newspapers. They don't watch the BBC News. It's all social media derived. So it's all affected by these algorithms. And that is dangerous. And there's a great quote in the book from an Italian student who was at university who said to me, "I find it practically impossible to have any meaningful debate with my fellow students because at the beginning of the discussion, we can't agree on the facts because the facts they've got are different from the facts I've got. And if you can't agree on the facts, then you can't get into the argument about, you know, whether something is right or wrong." So that's why it's so dangerous.
Yeah, they used to say you could have your own opinion, but you can't have your own facts. But now you can because you only have to look on the internet and you can find your own facts, can't you?
You can. And more specifically, you can just be fed a lot of one side of the argument repeatedly.
Yeah, what I also find is there seems to be a lot of people, and I worry this a bit about my twins are 20, they're studying history and politics and everything, but I worry about them a bit with this sort of thing is that it's a very good place to go if you want to feed the wolf. Now, we've all heard the tale of the two wolves, the good wolf and the bad wolf. Don't feed the bad wolf because, you know, it's not healthy for you. But the idea is that people keep on going online. You see it so often with celebrities and they go, "I'm going to argue for the left," or "I'm going to argue for the right," knowing for a fact that they're going to start this chain of events where they're having an imaginary argument with these fictitious people on social media. But it seems really prevalent. And then people come on and they start wanting to argue with them. And it seems to be fulfilling them in some very strange way. They're just constantly feeding the bad wolf and having these imaginary arguments. This seems to be something which is happening a lot as I witness it on the internet.
So one point I would make about that is going back to what I was saying about anonymity. See, one of the problems is that you can say pretty much what you like, however offensive and however wrong, if people don't know who you are. And indeed, there are even one or two, you know, social media platforms who specialize in creating the environment for that kind of behavior. If you got rid of anonymity, people would be much more measured in what they said. And of course, it would cut out a lot of racism and abuse. for example, people being anti particular minorities, because if people knew you were, you wouldn't say it.
Yeah, you were talking about dating earlier, and in your book, there was a fact that 50% of people on those apps are lying about their profile. I mean, that's a huge amount, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I compare when we grew up, what did we do? We used to go to the local pub or the youth club. You know, there were three girls. You picked the one you thought was most attractive. She said, you know, not interested. So you sort of tried someone else. Now you've got a choice of 100, swipe right, swipe left. And of course, they're not just in your local area. They can be in a much wider geographical area. So just to be clear, I'm not against dating apps. I think they change the way you date. They're not bad of themselves, but they themselves are designed to be addictive. And what my survey, my little survey of a group of people that I know who use them showed is that they very quickly become addictive, and that they don't very often lead to relationships. They lead to a lot of transactional encounters, if I can put it that way. And that's what the hookup culture is all about. And that's what most of our kids are now engaged in.
Yeah, and population is slowing down, isn't it? Population growth.
Yes. Well, that goes back to all those other factors I mentioned. Was it the divorce rate in London is now 50%? I mean, that'll decline because no one's going to get married in the future. Marriage is pretty much disappearing over the next 10 years, I would say. So the divorce rate will come down as a result. As a result, people are not living in families as they were. As I said, religion is declining. And anyway, listen, let's look at it like this. I don't know how you feel, but what are we leaving our children? We're leaving them a world which some people think we've severely damaged the planet. We've sort of got the hangover from the global financial crisis. We've just bundled them with a load of COVID debt. And we're giving them the what's called the continuing global war on terror. If I was an 18-year-old today, I'd be pretty hacked off with my parents. I'd say, what the hell have you guys done to my planet and my life? So then we call them, we say they're not very resilient and they're petals, which I think is the ultimate irony and the ultimately unfair criticism. Actually, what I find is Generation Z is doing exactly what you'd expect given the circumstances we're leaving them. They're saying, right, you guys have screwed everything up. So business needs to change. It needs to become what they call a social enterprise. It needs not just to make money, but it needs to solve societal problems. And if it doesn't, I don't want to work for that company. So we criticize this generation, I think, severely unfairly. I think we're leaving them a very difficult set of cards. And I think they're behaving exactly as I would, left with that, you know, with that kind of scenario.
What is Generation Z? When is that?
Well, it's sort of under 23, basically, at the moment, yeah.
So they all grew up with tech constantly. How close are we then to getting everyone so they have to be identified on the internet? How close
miles, is that? Miles away. Miles away, because it has to be done by 200 countries in the world, obviously. And in particular, really, it has to be done by the US, which, let's face it, the politics there would not be supportive of that at the moment. It's a libertarian country with, you know, a very strong right wing. So I don't see it happening in America anytime soon. I think in the UK we have some chance. In discussions with ministers, more and more MPs are beginning to understand, not least because of the abuse they could receive themselves, but of how getting rid of anonymity could improve behaviour on the internet. So, you know, I think we have some chance, but I wouldn't put it too highly at the moment.
I was looking in your book as well on the stats on China. Absolutely phenomenal, the use in China. But we don't get to see it, do we, really? Will there be a stage where China move into, I suppose they have with TikTok, is the rest of their internet, is it going to move into our world soon?
Well, the fascinating thing is that we in this country are quite prone to criticizing China over their human rights and all sorts of other things. The truth is that China, South Korea, Japan have probably had the worst adolescent internet addiction problems. It's largely around gaming, but not just gaming. And so the governments in those countries have taken pretty stringent action to try and protect their children. And of course, the cynics will say, oh, well, it's the government just trying to snoop on people and not allow news that doesn't support the regime. And there may be in different countries some truth in some of those arguments, but that's kind of not the point. They've had the worst internet addiction amongst adolescents. So they've taken act and they've got internet addiction clinics in some of these countries where they treat children They brought in very stringent regulation, like you can't game between 11 o'clock at night and 5 in the morning, or the parent can be prosecuted. That kind of level of regulation, in an attempt to do something about it. So I don't think we're in a position to criticize them on this one. I think we need to catch up. I'm not saying we need to take that particular measure, but the online safety bill, which the government is pushing through Parliament, will be the first Western government attempt to really take a holistic approach to trying to solve the problem.
Mm. Robert, thank you so much for doing this interview today. I suppose we should finish with some positives about the internet, or some ways that we can ways that we can look at our use so we get the benefit out of it without all the harm. I think the thing that I always say is, if you value something, show it attention. And in your book, you constantly talk about attention, which is great, because that's what's affecting this. The digital age is affecting our attention. We're too messy. So I suppose, have you got any tips for us from your journey through this world?
Well, there are some practical tips about thinking about how much time you spend on screen. But I think, as I said, it's really more about what you're doing when you're on screen and understanding what it might be doing to you and how it might be affecting your mental health. So education is probably the key thing. And then I'm afraid some discipline and the old, you know, adage about moderation in all things, you kind of need to apply it to your use of the internet. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you do some gaming, just don't do more than an hour a day. Doesn't matter if you watch a film, just don't watch three. You know, it's not, none of it's rocket science. It's about moderating, you know, your use of the internet and concentrating on the good things and trying to avoid the bad things. As again, the cyber security press I was talking about earlier says, she says, it's not that the internet is bad, it's that there are people who use it badly. And so it's about educating those people to use it better.
Robert, I have to, if ever I'm watching a film or the football or anything, I have to put my phone in another room. I'm honestly pathetic. But I think half the deal is realizing that you've slipped into that way of life, and that's half the battle, is I understand it. I wish I could just, I always think if I leave television and maybe stop doing this, I'd just throw my phone away, because I think I'd have a happier life. But at the moment, it's a necessary evil. Thank you so much for joining me. Born Digital, The Story of a Distracted Generation. Fantastic book. The facts and figures in here are phenomenal. Thank you very much for joining me today, Robert.
Tim, thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for such great questions.